Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Enabling Open Architectures in Rugged ISR Applications. My name is John McHale, Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems Magazine and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Roger Hosking, Vice President and Co-Founder with Pentek, David Barnett, Vice President of Products and Markets at RTI, and Earl Olson, Business Development Manager for TE Connectivity. Now for some short housekeeping announcements. This eCast will consume about 35 to 40 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Before we get going, I want to point out three important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you will be able to view the slides in full screen mode. The second important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to send an email request for this event. The third button on your console that we want to look at allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to each speaker. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. This eCast will be archived online today and will be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available as well. Now I'm pleased to turn it over to Roger Hosking. Roger, take her away.
All right. Thanks, John, and welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us today. Today what I'm going to talk about is how Pentek has taken advantage of some new technologies to enable rugged ISR applications. So what we're going to start with is to take a look at some of the things that are critical. I call them system essentials for rugged ISR, and they are basically the basis of open architectures for building these systems is really important to improve the product availability and compatibility among vendors. We need to eliminate system bottlenecks, and so we need faster system interfaces to move the data at these higher data rates. We need to improve the thermal management because of the high density of the components and the amount of power that they draw. This is becoming a more significant issue for ISR. And as technology evolves in communications and radar, we need to deal with wider and wider signal bandwidths. So we need to handle hundreds of megahertz in some case. We also, in order to detect weak signals or weak signals in the presence of small signals, we need a high dynamic range on our, especially our software radio products, so we can identify all of the different assets and targets that might be in the area. We need to be able to reconfigure the systems easily. Field upgradability and adaptive operation during a mission is very critical. And then last, we're also concerned about the security of these systems in case the vehicles, for example, if it is such, gets captured. So we want it to be tamper-proof as possible. So now what I'm going to do now is take a look at some specific examples of how these essentials have been addressed through primarily open standards. And the first major standard that we're using now to address these applications is OpenVPX, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. It's also known as Vita 65. It is the leading industry standard for ruggedized systems. It defines the form factor, topology, power, control, I.O. It also has standard profiles that define exactly how backplanes are configured, the topologies, the slots in the backplanes, and then also the modules of the cards that plug into the backplanes. OpenVPX provides very fast gigabit serial links that replace the slower parallel buses like BME, for example, and PCI. There are several different thermal management techniques, including forced air, air flow through, liquid, and conduction cooling, all defined in standards under the Open VPX architecture. The Open VPX does provide then this multi-vendor compatibility and interoperability, which is really important to customers. And the last point here is that there are some new standards within the OpenVPX that define interfaces for RF and optical, digital optical, across the backplane I.O. So I wanted to look first at some of these last two, the optical and the RF interfaces, which are quite exciting for a lot of important reasons in these types of applications. First of all, the Vita 66 defines an optical connector for moving data back and forth from a card or a module in a VPX system to the backplane. It's based on a Molex ruggedized optical MT connector that you can see here. You can see the two halves. And these parts then provide 12 full duplex optical links. Data rates now actually are higher than this. They're up to as high as 14 gigabytes per second. And the two connectors can be just engaged, blind mate, and establish a very high-speed connection. So, for example, the one part of the connector would be on the card or the module, and the other part of the connector would be on the backplane, as you can see here in this diagram. At the other end, you can see the flat ribbon cables that are coming out. Those are actually bonded optical cables, 12 in each of those small cables that you see there, 12 optical fibers that Samtec has created a module for both for a receive and a transmit module that will interface electrical signals on the board or on the card to these optical connectors that go into the backplane. Yesterday, Samtec was in here and they showed us the conduction-cooled versions of these, which don't have those finned heat sinks, allowing us to get these types of interfaces directly on a 3U or 6U VPX module. So it's very exciting. It's a new way of getting extremely high-speed data to between the backplane and a card module without having to resort to front panel connections. The next, and we will be introducing a product first quarter. The next technology is the Vita 67 standard, which defines analog RF IO across the backplane. What this does is it eliminates the front panel connectors that are always a problem in dealing with embedded systems. It's a lot easier in terms of serviceability, maintainability, to have those connections done across the backplane simply by engaging the module in the into the enclosure. So there are a lot of benefits to going across these backplane connectors. There are two sub specifications, which include the 67.1 for 3U VPX, which has four coaxial RF connectors. You can see the male and the female parts of those connectors on the card and on the backplane shown here. And then the Vita 67.2 shows you eight lanes instead of four for the 6U VPX form factor. So these are being supported on some of our new VPX modules. The next technology is basically trying to get as much bandwidth as we can into a 3U conduction-cooled VPX module. In this case, we have a product that's based on the Vertex 7 FPGA, our 53741. That gives us lots of horsepower. Up at the front end, we have a 3.6 gigasample per second 12-bit A-to-D converter to digitize the very wide bandwidths that we're having to deal with in these new ISR systems. We've got a digital down converter, memory for storing and buffering data, and then last, in terms of trying to achieve these very high backplane bandwidths, we are implementing a PCI Gen 3 system interface to deliver 8 gigabytes per second from the module out to the backplane. Again, another way of eliminating bottlenecks in the systems and digitizing extremely high bandwidths. Another example is the 53762. This is another conduction-cooled 3U VPX module with four 200 megahertz 16-bit A to D converters, synchronization features to simplify your system design, digital down converters, and extremely high spurious-free dynamic range. This we mentioned as one of the essentials in trying to get as much dynamic range as possible in order to detect the very weakest signals that might be out there that need to be acquired and processed, analyzed, identified, classified, and so forth. So this module then fits right into that open VPX standard for those types of very sensitive signals, if you want. The Gate Express Configuration Manager is a feature that we've put installed in our Vertex 7 FPGA-based 3U VPX modules, And it allows you to completely reconfigure the entire FPGA across the host interface, the PCI Express interface, which allows you to change the application simply by running an application on the host to reload the FPGA. And this can be done during runtime without the requirement of rebooting the system, which is often very inconvenient, especially for an unmanned vehicle. Rebooting an unmanned vehicle can be kind of painful. So this does support over-the-air reconfiguration of an FPGA in a UAV, so it can adapt to different mission requirements. The other nice thing about this is you don't need to store sensitive FPGA code in a non-volatile memory. This is very important in case the vehicle should be captured and someone tries to reverse engineer the algorithms that are being used in a very highly sensitive application that might be running in the UAV for, say, signal classification or identification. So again, we're giving this as a special benefit to the kinds of applications that are likely to be found in unmanned vehicles for ISR. Putting some of these things together into a recording application as an example, we support our recorders, and these are based on our software radio modules like the ones we looked at. You can take the data in across from the backplane, either analog or digital I.O., into a recording subsystem that might be part of an unmanned vehicle for ISR. It uses the PCI Express links on the backplane to move data between the modules, between the data converters, between the storage arrays, the RAID controllers, and so forth, to eliminate those bottlenecks. And the CPU card in the system just orchestrates the DMA transfers. Again, what we're trying to do is trying to eliminate bottlenecks for these recording applications so that they can work as fast as possible for the wideband signals that we have to deal with. An example of a recorder is this. This is a 3U VPX conduction cooled recorder, and it's supported in an open VPX architecture. And again, just an example as a backplane profile for the backplane that goes inside of this module, this backplane profile is, again, defined as one of the open VPX profiles. It defines the slots. It defines the connectivity between the modules. And then you also then have a listing of exactly which specific profiles are compatible with that backplane. And each module has its own definition of the slot profile nomenclature and the module profile, which is the card that plugs into it. It has its own definition. These types of standards that are part of the OpenVPX really help to make the OpenVPX architecture open. And the key features that are supported for rugged ISR, again, is the high dynamic range, obviously vibration intolerance, and a very small size that's suitable for fitting into a relatively small unmanned vehicle. So these are just some of the highlights of technologies that we're involved with. We found that OpenVPX really does offer now, especially it's growing every day, a lot of different vendors, over 35 vendors and over 350 products currently available to choose from in OpenVPX. It gets rid of the bottleneck in the backplane by using fast gigabit serial interconnects. There are a lot of very well-defined thermal management strategies. We have the profiles for the backplanes, for the modules, for the slots that help define exactly how the boards are made. We've also developed systems that use multi-vendor card sets, and we find that they do operate well together. And it takes a little bit of work, obviously, but with these standards, it really helps you to put together systems that will work. And our military customers really see an industry-wide sustained commitment to OpenVPX, and so they're more comfortable in basing a larger long-term program on a standard that's been widely adopted. We looked at some new technologies in OpenVPX for backplane RF and optical links, and we also talked a little bit about the reconfigurability of the FPGA for flexibility and safeguarding secure applications. So that's the end of my presentation. I invite you to ask any questions later on, and also to visit pentech.com for more information about these products or to contact us. So that's the end. I will turn it back over to John.
Thanks, Roger. And as Roger mentioned, please feel free to ask questions. We will get to them all once the final speaker is done. We'll have our Q&A session to answer all of your inquiries. Now I will turn over to our next speaker, David Barnett. David?
Thank you, John, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. What I'm going to be doing is introducing the DDS, or Data Distribution Service Standard, which provides a software foundation for open architecture systems. So the challenge that DDS addresses is how do I connect different applications, devices, subsystems, and systems so that they can communicate and share data. So this can be within a system, sort of the example on the left, a ground control station, is how do I share sensor data with my user interface, with weapons controller that might need targeting information, and then communication to other systems that also need that data. So both within a ground control station or within an unmanned vehicle. And then on the right, how do I share data between systems? So how do I share that data that I, intelligence or surveillance data I'm getting, from a UAV, how do I share that with the, airmen, soldiers, Marines, sailors that might actually need that data? So it's both within a system and within a systems of systems, how do I exchange data? So if you look traditionally at how this has been done, it's been using what I call point-to-point integration. So if each of these circles kind of on the left here, can represent an application or subsystem, I basically hard code all those connections between devices. So my sensor knows about the different applications that might need that sensor data. So when I have a new application that needs sensor data, I have to build, a custom bridge or custom connection between that sensor and those different applications that might need it, perhaps a user interface, a recorder, the communications link that's going to share that data outside. So all the connections in a system, are explicit and effectively hard-coded. And the real challenge here is this gets, clearly very expensive as you get more connections in a system and want to share data more broadly. It also gets very complex over time. So it's easy if it's just, two applications to connect them together. But, when you've got 100 applications, it's, orders of magnitude more difficult to do that. And then also because you've got all this individual point-to-point integration logic, systems just become very stovepipe and brittle over time. So, at a certain point, you don't want to touch it anymore because the people that knew how it worked, they're not around anymore. You can't trust that all the ICDs that document the interfaces are still accurate. And because you've got hard-coded connections, it's very difficult to reuse a component across different systems because it has to be custom integrated with each system that you're using it in, and also very hard to quickly reconfigure a system. So if I want to swap out, a video sensor for a radar sensor, it's just not as easy from a software perspective as plugging and playing a different pod. There's software work that has to happen also. So a ramification of that is as you want to share data more broadly, so as the scale of your systems grows, your integration costs tend to grow exponentially, and they also do that over time as well, just as sort of the knowledge of how the system works is lost or erodes over time, and then the complexity increases. And the ICDs maybe become out of sync with the actual systems themselves. So over time, it basically becomes cost prohibitive to better integrate systems, to make changes to a system, to do any sort of reconfiguration, and eventually you just don't want to touch it anymore. So really the cost of integrating with traditional approaches is what constrains your ability to better share data for better situational awareness and speed of command. So what DDS offers is a different approach to integration than this classic approach that, we often relate to really a software equivalent of a data bus or a computer bus, where different software modules or applications or devices in your system basically just become plug-and-play components that you plug into this software data bus. And as you plug components in, they're automatically discovered by other components, and the middleware, the data distribution service middleware infrastructure, actually then handles all the data communication between those different components. So different components no longer need any sort of explicit knowledge or custom bridges between other components. So what this gives you is a very simple, loosely coupled architecture as an alternative to traditional point-to-point integration. And it's much more scalable then to large projects and systems of systems because you don't have any of these custom bridges or connections between applications. It also makes it very easy to reconfigure a system because if I swap out the type of sensor, I don't necessarily need to go change the recorder, for example, that's the recording the data from that sensor in my UAV as an example. So it's a very different approach. The foundation for this approach is what we call the publish-subscribe communication paradigm. So basically the way it works is that an application that produces data, say a sensor there on the left, it just publishes the data. It doesn't know anything about who's consuming that data. It says, I've got, you know, radar data or video data. The sensor just goes ahead and publishes it. Then any application that needs that type of data just subscribes to it. So, for example, you know, I have a control application that needs that sensor data. So it's subscribing to sensor data. The data distribution service infrastructure is just automatically sending that sensor data to the control application. Likewise, the control application, as a result of that data, might be sent a command somewhere else to an actuator somewhere. So it's publishing commands, the actuator is subscribing. And again, none of these applications have any real knowledge of each other. They just, all they need to know about is the type of data that they produce or consume. So what happens is then if I want to add, for example, another sensor, it's really very trivial to do that to the system. I just add another sensor, it publishes sensor data, and now my control application is getting sensor data from two sensors instead of getting data from one sensor. Likewise, I might want to add a new capability to my system. I might want to put in a display app so the operator, you know, for example, can now see what's going on in real time. I can just add that display application. It's going to subscribe to sensor data and maybe subscribe. It might want to monitor the commands or the status of the actuator, so it just subscribes to that data. No application had a change to enable that. It's just taking advantage of the data that's, you know, effectively already on the bus. So that's really how DDS works. So all these components, they're very loosely coupled, and again, each component in the system doesn't need any knowledge of any other component. It's just sort of like using a database. When you read data into a database, you don't know what applications are going to use that database. Likewise, if I'm reading data from a database, I don't know where that data comes from. So DDS sort of provides that equivalent capability, but in a real-time manner. So DDS is a standard from an organization called the Object Management Group that a lot of you may be familiar with. It also does the UML standard and did the CORBA standard that was popular in the 1990s. So it's the same organization. It has a very open, well-defined process for contributing to the standard. There's at least 10 different implementations of the DDS standard, and it's designed specifically for real-time and mission-critical systems that have timing constraints and, you know, really uninterrupted uptime requirements. So in a lot of these systems, it's not feasible to shut the whole thing down so that you can do an upgrade. So DDS is designed specifically for systems, you know, that need more than 5.9 availability, so no single point of failure in the architecture, and systems can be dynamically upgraded. The DDS standard itself defines both a standard application programming interface, so applications are portable across different DDS implementations because they're using the same API. It also defines a standard wire or network protocol, so a subsystem that's using one DDS implementation can seamlessly interoperate with a subsystem that uses a different DDS implementation. So what this gives you as a systems integrator is basically middleware and subsystem vendor independence, because I don't care as an application developer what DDS implementation I'm running over, and as a systems integrator, I don't have to care which DDS implementation my different suppliers might be using, because they can all interoperate across the wire. So there's, in practice, really two ways to use DDS. So as I mentioned, DDS has a standard API. So if you look on the left, if I'm developing new applications or I'm updating existing applications, I can just write those applications to the DDS API. And DDS, it's basically just a library that you embed in your application, just like you're calling into an operating system or a graphics library. You call into the DDS library, and it basically just sits as a layer between your application and the underlying communication stack, be it a TCP or UDP stack, or some other communication mechanism you might have, like shared memory. If I have existing applications, as is shown on the right, and maybe I don't want to change those applications or I don't have control over those applications, then you can use DDS indirectly through what we call a routing service or a bridge, where I'm basically taking whatever legacy protocol and data formats that application might be using, and I'm just bridging it to DDS so that over the wire it's talking the DDS RTPS wire interoperability protocol. So that way I can get sort of seamless interoperability between a new or updated application that's directly using DDS and between existing applications or systems that are using some legacy protocol. I don't have to go update all my existing applications to migrate or take advantage of DDS. So basically it provides a very smooth migration for existing systems. DDS itself is completely decentralized, so there are no central brokers or servers required in a DDS system. All the different applications communicate, you know, what we call peer-to-peer. So there's no intermediate software layers. So if you're, for example, embedding the DDS library, I don't have any services or servers that have to run anywhere in my network. DDS is also designed to be interoperable across a very broad range of systems. So this is what RTI supports. So a lot of different languages, all the, you know, C++, C#, Java, Ada. We have, you know, a REST or HTTP interface. We integrate with LabVIEW, MATLAB, Simulink, UML tools. We run on about 70 to 80 different combinations of operating system and processor, and also can run over a lot of different underlying network transports. So it could be shared memory, it could be your backplane, it could be a local area network using unicast or multicast over a wide area network. And again, the advantage of DDS is this is all completely application transparent, you know, what type of network you're running over, and when I have a, you know, publisher publishing sensor data that's written in C, that's completely transparent to a, you know, GUI application that's maybe displaying that data and perhaps is written in Java. So again, you don't care what language sort of the components you're communicating with are written in. For those of you who are familiar with the Future Airborne Capability Environment standard known as FACE, DDS also fits very well into a FACE architecture, which is being adopted a lot across the U.S. DoD for any new avionics or really airborne systems in general. So FACE has DDS as one of the transports under FACE, so it basically provides kind of a thin API on top of DDS, so you can take advantage of the DDS paradigm with the FACE API as defined by the FACE standard, and RTI has an implementation of that. So for those of you familiar with kind of the emerging open architecture avionics standard, DDS fits very well into that new standards initiative. So kind of want to look at sort of two real case studies about from DDS users. So the first one here comes from NAVAIR. They were one of the early adopters of DDS for an upgrade of the Hawkeye E2C. So in their particular case, they had a legacy architecture that looked a lot like what I showed you earlier, where they had point-to-point connections between the different subsystems on board the aircraft. And what happened is they wanted to add a new capability, the cooperative engagement capability. And what they found is that in order to add that new capability, they actually had to go rework, I forget the exact number, but, you know, a dozen or 16, maybe it was on the order of about 16 different subsystems that already were existed and working and deployed. They had to change in order to support the cooperative engagement capability. So it became very expensive to add this particular upgrade. So they looked at, well, if we move to something like an object-oriented approach, does that help? And they found that didn't really help. It just changed the way you drew the picture. But in practice, you still needed all that integration. So in the end, what they discovered is, you know, DDS, by providing that, you know, software data bus and using publish-subscribe communication, provided all of that decoupling so that when they went and added capabilities like CEC to the system, they no longer had to go change any of the other existing components. So this is really all their words. So really, you know, in their mind, about an architecture that can assimilate evolving functionality very easily, much more so than the traditional point-to-point integration approaches. Another example is a Blue Force tracking system that we're in. So they had a legacy capability, again, took a very traditional approach, lots of code, took a very long time to develop. And because all this custom point-to-point integration logic was very heavyweight, it needed a lot of compute infrastructure to run on. So their particular system had about 21 servers in order to support 20,000 track updates a second. When they switched over to a DDS-based system, because their legacy system basically, or existing system, just couldn't keep up with the volume of track data, they significantly reduced the line of code count because they didn't need all of this custom integration logic anymore. So they went from 500,000 lines of code down to 50,000 lines of code. They were able to migrate the system in about a year versus the 8 years it originally took to develop. And they were actually able to support about 250,000 tracks a second, up from 20,000, on a single laptop. Again, because all of this custom integration logic was no longer necessary. And the 250,000 tracks was actually about all that their test framework could inject into the system. So it wasn't an inherent limit. It was actually just a limit of what they could test. So you can see very, very significant improvement by moving to DDS. So just briefly a little bit about RTI. So we are the leading vendor of DDS and of middleware targeting embedded and real-time systems in general. So according to independent market analysts, we have about 70% share of the DDS market. We're very active in standards overall. So we are the author of the DDS standard. We are co-chair of the special interest group that maintains and evolves the standard, as well as we participate in about 15 other standards organizations, including the FACE standard I mentioned earlier for airborne software. And our software is very widely used. It's used in about 600 or closer to 700 products today, and we also support a lot of research projects, both IRADs and university projects. So we're being used in about 400, you know, future-looking projects. And we're shipped now in over 500,000 different copies of our software are deployed in real systems today, so it does meet the requirements of U.S. DoD technology readiness level 9. Our DDS product family consists of a couple different solutions. So kind of on the left here is our general purpose DDS product. So it supports basically a superset of the DDS standards. So it supports the DDS API. We also support the JMS API. Kind of in the middle there, we have a small footprint implementation designed for very size, weight, and power constrained systems. And on the right, we have a certifiable version of our product designed for very high assurance systems. So for example, if you've got avionics systems or ground control stations that need to be certified by the FAA to the DO-178C Level A standard, we're in the process of generating certification evidence right now for what is, I think, generally viewed as the most stringent safety standard out there today. We have also on the right here routing service, as I showed you before, a way to basically integrate existing applications without having to modify them to use the DDS API. And all of these applications are supported by a common set of tools and services. So, for example, one of the services we have is a recording service, which tends to be pretty useful in an ISR application where you may, during a mission, you might have, for example, in a UAV, a very low bandwidth link between the UAV and the ground. So you can only, during missions, send a limited amount of data. But what you want to do is record all that data in mission for post-mission analysis. So the recording service lets you do that. And again, because DDS decouples the data producers and consumers, the recording service doesn't necessarily have to change or be reconfigured if you switch the type of sensor pod you had. So if I change sensors, I don't need to reconfigure all of this DDS infrastructure. It will just discover the new application and automatically work. So just to kind of summarize, DDX open architecture really is what enables cost-effective integration of larger-scale systems. And systems of systems lets you reuse software rapidly, reconfigure software or systems even in the field if you want to, for example, change sensor types. And basically, by making it affordable, makes it much easier to share data across systems to improve situational awareness. And then DDS really provides the ideal software foundation for open architecture systems by eliminating traditional, very expensive point-to-point integration, giving you seamless plug-and-play interoperability across different applications, devices, subsystems of systems, both new and existing systems. And SAT, again, designed specifically to satisfy the needs of very mission-critical systems that require, you know, really uninterrupted, nonstop availability, as well as operate with real-time constraints. So with that, I want to thank you again for joining us today and turn it back over to you, John.
Thanks, David. Now we will turn it back to Earl Olson, and I thank you, those of you who have sent in questions so far. Please ask you to continue to do so, and once Earl's presentation is done, we will start our Q&A session. Earl, take it away.
Great. Thanks, John. And appreciate the time everybody's dedicated to the presentation. Just for a minute, I'd like to just return to a little bit of Roger's and David's content and just underline the fact that as we go forward, SWAP, or SWAPs in this case, size, weight, and power, and speed, the reality of life is that the demand for reducing the power consumption and the weight and size, but not sacrificing the performance, is really the primary goal in today's market. With that said, just a quick mention as to the aerospace, defense, and marine business within TE Connectivity, just to give everyone on the phone an idea of what this division is. Covers anything from commercial aerospace all the way through to C4ISR with a very extensive product toolkit and a wide resource base of industry experts. With the information surveillance and reconnaissance industry, as Roger had pointed out quite well, some of the platforms and challenges are to provide good quality connectivity, end-to-end connectivity, as well as excellent performance within the box, as well as inside to the input-output interfaces as well, along with high bandwidth demands served by fiber optic and fast copper. Within TE, we do address a number of the ISR applications, and if you don't mind, a little bit of literary license also within the commercial aerospace with in-flight networking and in-flight entertainment. Many of the demands are very similar from a commercial through to a military style application. One of the aspects within all of that is the end-to-end connectivity and enabling it from a data integrity aspect, assuring the data throughput, the MI environment, resistance to degradation, as well as mechanical integrity, make sure that it's going to last for the long term. Within inside the box, TE Connectivity's had a good history here. You might say it's a very, very long history. If we go back to the AMP brand, we helped set many of the standards to date, and that continued forward within the VPX community. So anything from the Vita 46 all the way through the RF modules that Roger had mentioned, as well as being integral in the creation and definition of the Vita 66 modules with 66.1, 2, and 3, and soon on the horizon, the half-size module with Vita 66.4, as well as solutions here on the right within power solutions, mezzanine solutions, along with a new higher bandwidth solution set, which we call the Fortis ZD. And then there's also a new on the horizons interface for blade server type of applications with the Fortis ZD line replaceable module connector set. So there's a good good solid set of tools for inside the box. With that said, now as we go to an input-output, one of the things that has been happening as we demand more out of performance for the input-output connector is going from the 10-100 and gigabit to the 10 gigabit, and then solution sets for multimode and single-mode fiber. Certainly the demand is there, and it's starting to accelerate. What we've done is, with specific attention to the high-speed I/O with copper, is we've done a study to objectively quantify the high-speed signaling characteristics and to try to understand some of the limitations of a select-loaded I/O, let's say a 3899 Series 3 as an example. So what has been happening is that open pin fields have been select-loaded. You see that in the lower portion of the presentation slide here, where you'll try to find a somewhat of a dielectric separation to try to create a balance for the signal lines and try to keep an open eye with the signal integrity. So we go forward through that. As an example, would be a typical wiring configuration where the center three contacts are left blank to try to achieve some sort of balance, but you tend to couple as the speed increases, let's say from contact 7 to 8, 5 to 4, and 3 to 2. So as we continue down the path for testing, we decided that we'd like to try to understand the performance aspects for gigabit and 10 gigabit Ethernet and do it per the TIA 568C.2 with a 1 meter cable, and then, as you can see, the test groups, and looking at three set tests, or three groups, and see how it performed. With an open pin field pattern, that, as I mentioned earlier, with a shell size 11 and the contact pattern, you see that the limit line, you even with two made a pair, you tend to lose some of the headroom. And as it progresses into the three mated pair, the four mated pair, and then subsequently the five total mated pairs, you end up with not a good signal path. One of the things that TE Connectivity has been working on is matched impedance solution sets, both at the motherboard daughter card level as well as in the I/O. It's a new product that we came out with that we have coined the name FAST-T. That comes from the pin pattern. What we do get is a very good, solid matched impedance aspect by getting the pair separation in a dedicated build. If we look at that now and bring the multiple mated FAST-T connector pairs for Cat6A cable limit and repeat the test here, with a dedicated matched impedance interface, we're getting excellent performance with that Cat6A layout. And then if we press forward here, we look at a new product family that we have called FAST-X, where we have a dedicated contact set with, you might remember as the Quadrex connector families, but in this case what we have is a contact for the pairs around the clock dial there. And we're, again, getting a successful performance with that dedicated interface. And then if we just take a look at the open pin field within the matched impedance interface, the FAST-T and the FAST-X, you can see that the 1 gigabit results are, for a full link set, is not good on the open pin field versus the matched impedance set. And then in the 10 gig, again, just to summarize that. So The struggle is that as we move from a 10 to 100, then gigabit, even in the gig E, the open pin field, once you go beyond the one mated pair, becomes quite iffy. And what we maintain is that to be able to put a number of these in line, you'll need a dedicated matched impedance interface to be successful in your higher bandwidth needs. With that said, though, many systems, as Roger had mentioned, with the use of VITA 66.1, And then also for the I.O., we're also participant in a number of industry standards. VITA is one of them. SAE is another. ARINC is another within the fiber optic realm. And any number of solution sets are available for both the commercial air, general avionics, and mil air, as well as for the ISR market. So optics is also a very good solid path, immune to MIRFI effects, and something that is finally getting its day. So with that, I will hand it back over to John.
Thank you, Earl, and thank you, Roger and David. Now we will get to our Q&A session. Our first question from the audience is for Roger. Does data rate vary based on whether the link is a half duplex or full duplex? Which one of these is widely used in ISR applications presently, and what is the trend?
Okay. For the higher-level protocols like PCI Express, for example, full duplex is the rule. You do need the messaging going back and forth in both directions for to complete a transaction. In the case of data, there is a provision of flow control. If you're going to hold off data from coming to you, then you'll need full duplex to implement the reverse channel flow control. The only time that you probably wouldn't need the full duplex is if you have a raw data channel that's very high speed with maybe over a costly link that you just want to send raw data and you don't need flow control. So, in fact, the fact of full or half duplex makes no difference on the transfer rate because you're always transferring data in one direction primarily. If you do have a bidirectional transfer situation where you're transferring data back and forth simultaneously, then you will gain aggregate additional bandwidth by using both both of the channels, reverse and forward, at the same time. But otherwise, going in one direction, you gain no bandwidth going to the full duplex versus half duplex. Hope that answered the question.
Thanks, Roger. Next question. Why would this web-based publish-subscribe approach be a superior approach architecture than, say, SOA?
Sure. I'm assuming that one's for me. So,
yes, David, sorry.
Yes, I think, you know, some people do consider DDS to be a foundation for real-time service-oriented architecture. So a lot of our customers refer to DDS as being SOA or real-time SOA. I think there is one difference between the way DDS is generally used and, you know, kind of I think a traditional notion of SOA around services that tend to be very application-specific. Whereas what DDS is really much more data-centric. So rather than invoking a specific operation on a service to say, you know, display a data update, you publish data and the service that needs the data subscribes to that data. So it tends to, from a, you know, API or developer perspective, you know, look a lot more like using a database, say, than a traditional web service, although it can certainly be used, you know, as a traditional web service as well. So it, you know, has a lot of flexibility built in. But it really supports all the SOA principles like, you know, loose coupling and location independence and modularity. So from that perspective, it looks like a SOA. It's not in general, while we have a RESTful interface like you find in a SOA, you know, with the standard traditional DDS interface and API, you would be using it much more like you would use, say, a database from a paradigm perspective.
Thanks, David. It looks like a follow-up to what you were answering just came through. Is DDS a lightweight version of SOA?
Yes, so I think that's often the view of it because it is, you know, it does not need an enterprise service bus. For example, you don't necessarily have to have an HTTP server, so we can, you know, our small footprint version requires about 200 kilobytes of memory. So it's often viewed as a lightweight or real-time service-oriented architecture in that sense.
Thanks, David. The next question is for Earl or David. What are the critical factors to be considered when we decide to integrate multiple sets of systems to ride on a common data backbone, for example, IPMS, bridge systems, communication power management, LAN, et cetera, on board a marine platform? Which set of systems will need autonomous data buses? Which one would you like to go first?
David, do you want to go? Comment too. Go ahead.
Sure, yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of that's going to depend on your specific architecture. So in a DDS system, you can have multiple, you know, the data bus itself is really virtual since there is no server. So a couple factors to consider when partitioning your system, you know, one is security. So you want to isolate subsystems or systems that are part of different security domains so that you're basically controlling data sharing both within a domain and then between a domain, particularly when there might be different, you know, requirements, you know, or different control over those different domains. So that's one factor to consider. Also, the amount of data that is shared across a domain is also important. So if you have, you know, say within a system, you know, very high speed requirements, you know, you probably want to make one virtual bus for those applications, you know, that probably need to communicate peer-to-peer and maintain very low latency, and then, you know, kind of maybe a separate higher level integration bus across systems where you might be sharing less data across those different systems. And again, that way you can control, using the routing service I talked about before, basically control which data and how much data flows between systems. So for example, maybe I'm running over a backplane or shared memory, you know, within a specific subsystem, but then I'm running over, you know, a local area network or wide area network or even, you know, a lossy or satellite network in between subsystems. So I want to have a control point to basically throttle the data that's flowing across systems. So, you know, those are just two of the considerations, you know,
right,
to make when sort of deciding how to partition a system.
Right, and I think, as I mentioned in the physical layer, what you do need as system designers to consider is how that will best be able to be assured with a matched impedance in the copper aspect, as well as if you're going to go fiber, what the overall link budget would be from the transmit to receive, and to assure that you're going to have successful communication to support the backbone.
Thank you, gentlemen. Next question from the audience. P2P is generally prohibited on DoD nets. How do you deal with information assurance issues with DDS? I'm assuming with the DDS on the end, that's one's for David.
Yeah, and actually I'm going to see if I can go back to an earlier slide here. Probably easier to use a visual aid. So, you know, typically within a subsystem or system, it's fine to use peer-to-peer communication. So really what one would end up with is kind of a hybrid architecture of the picture on the left on this slide and the picture on the right. So within a system where I'm allowed to have peer-to-peer, I would basically have my different DDS components directly communicating with each other, like on the right, or on the left of the picture, rather. Then between subsystems or systems where I might be going over a network that doesn't allow peer-to-peer, I'll use that routing service effectively as the bridge. So I'll have everything, you know, within a domain communicating peer-to-peer, sort of on its own virtual bus. Then where I have sort of what says unmodified app on the right there actually doesn't have to be an app. That can be a full system. So that unmodified app would effectively be a peer-to-peer subsystem communicating with a routing service over that, you know, typically what would then be a wide area network where I may not want or where peer-to-peer may not be allowed. So you'd use the routing service to effectively isolate the peer-to-peer segments of your application or system from portions that are not peer-to-peer.
Thank you, David. Next question is for Roger Hosking. What is the relationship between digital BW and BPS, analog BW of the channel, and the rise times of signals in the channel?
Okay. First of all, in bits per second, there's a rule of thumb that you get approximately one-tenth the bits per second in terms of bytes per second. 8 bits per byte, and then there's some overhead. So if I have a 1 gigabit per second channel, I could achieve about 100 megabytes per second, let's say. Now, in the analog bandwidth, we're sampling data with A to D conversions and so forth, and in that case, the digital rate of the data coming out of the data converter, which is the sample rate, has to be at least twice the bandwidth, the analog bandwidth of the signal. So, typically, you want to have it, say, 2.5 times. So if I want to sample a signal at 400 megahertz, I would want to use, let's say, a 1 giga sample per second A to D. So now once we've got the digital samples, and we have to look at how many bytes per sample. So at 1 gigahertz, for example, there are a billion samples per second, but you might have 12 or 14 bits in that sample. So that would be 2 bytes per sample times 1 giga sample per second would be 2 gigabytes per second. So you kind of relate the bandwidth to the sample rate to the number of bytes per sample, and then the number of bits that go over a transmission link. Typically, to gain higher bandwidth for example, the optical or the gigabit serial links, you bond lanes together where you would aggregate 4 or 8 or more lanes with the same logical channel, so that you'd gain a factor of 4 or 8 times the individual single bit per second rate of a single channel. So I hope, and in terms of rise time, I mean, that I believe you're asking is simply relates to the bandwidth. Whatever the bandwidth of the signal is, if the rise time can be accommodated within a certain bandwidth, then that really is the bandwidth. I hope I've answered your question.
Thanks, Roger. Next question is for David. How does DDS run over non-wired connections between devices users where the quality of the link is volatile and may affect DDS processes?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned earlier, DDS gives you very fine control over quality of service. So when running over, say what might be disconnected, intermittent, or low bandwidth or high delay networks, we support a couple of things. One is traffic shaping. So you can effectively reserve bandwidth for your different data flows based upon their needs and the priority of those different data flows. You also have control over the lifespan of data. So, for example, if a link is down or you're producing more data than you can send over the link, you can basically say, well, don't send any data that's, older than a second or older than a millisecond or whatever the appropriate timing is for your data. And also control how much historic data gets sent, say in a case, again, where maybe a network, you've lost the network for a while and then it comes back. You don't want to send, I don't need the last 100 sensor values. Maybe I just need the last 2 or 3 for my algorithm, or maybe I just need the last value. So basically DDS, for each data flow or type of data in your system, lets you configure all of those properties. In addition, we do support things for when you're on very low bandwidth networks. We have a set of plugins that will let you even do compression of data to further reduce the bandwidth requirements. DDS itself has its own reliability protocol, or can even just run in a best effort mode without reliability, so we don't depend on, say, something like TCP or having a reliable network. So the assumption that DDS itself makes is that your network is unreliable, and it's sort of a bonus if you happen to have a reliable network. So it's very optimized to run over low bandwidth and intermittent networks.
Thank you, David. Now for our last question, it's for Earl. In ADM, how prevalent is retrofitment of fiber optic data bus in systems having traditional copper data bus with an objective to avail the advantages of FO cables, fiber optic cables?
I think I understand that. In the commercial air aspect, that happens in the retrofit aspect of the aircraft. In a naval environment, many times the cable plant will be left in place and then just string a new cable hooking up to the new boxes. So we are seeing more fiber being installed, and also in once the ships, both carrier class and let's say battleship, destroyer class will come in for a full retrofit. So, but yes, there's more fiber being put in every day. Okay.
Hopefully thank you, Earl.
That.
Think so. Well, that brings us right up to our time limit for today. I would like to thank Roger Hosking, David Barnett, and Earl Olson for speaking. I'd also like to thank Pentek, RTI, and Tini Connectivity for sponsoring today's event. This eCast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There also will be an MP3 version available as well. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future OS Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.